to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 18th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, White House Spokesperson, Iowans Benefiting from Relief Money, Reynolds Opposed. A White House spokesperson criticized Governor Kim Reynolds for opposition to the American Rescue Plan in 2021, noting that the state has devoted millions of dollars to projects using federal money from the act. In a statement to the Courier Des Moines Bureau, White House regional spokesperson Harris Talwar said Reynolds, a Republican, called the $1.9 trillion federal relief package an unconstitutional stimulus bill that does nothing but bail out blue states. Another quote, "Now that the people of Iowa are benefiting through tens of thousands of jobs created and historic investments supporting childcare, expanding broadband, and improving school safety, we are grateful the governor has come around to recognizing the positive impacts of President Biden's American Rescue Plan on Iowa and the country," he said. Reynolds' spokesperson, Alex Murphy, did not provide a comment, but pointed to previous statements Reynolds had made on the issue. Last year, Reynolds told reporters the state would be very strategic on how we're using those funds, according to the Des Moines Register, and she reiterated that she opposed the high spending from the federal government. Democrats have been critical of Reynolds' opposition to the plan for close to a year, first making a note after she announced a $200 million investment in rural broadband made using the federal dollars. The American Rescue Plan Act, passed by Democrats on a party-line vote in 2021, delivered hundreds of billions of dollars to state and local governments to make up for COVID-19-related revenue loss. Representative Cindy Anks, a Democrat from Des Moines, was the only one of Iowa's congressional delegation to vote for the bill. The state received approximately $1.48 billion from the act, according to a database from the National Conference of State Legislatures. Speaking with the Sioux City Journal in 2021, Reynolds said the price tag of the American Rescue Plan was far too high and included funding in areas that should not have been included. "There's a cost to that. Somebody's got to pay for that at some point, and that punishes states that I think have been very targeted in their mitigation efforts and have tried to do the right thing," she said. But, she said then, the state would look at areas where relief was needed to spend the money in a targeted way. She mentioned business relief, mental health, and broadband funding as potential targets. "We still have small businesses that are hurting, people that have lost their jobs or lost their businesses, and put their entire life savings into it," she said. Reynolds also joined 21 other governors in signing a letter opposing the funding formula of the American Rescue Plan. They said the formula, which gave aid to states based on unemployment rates, punished states that kept businesses open during the pandemic. This week, Reynolds announced that the recipients of the $20 million in funding to nonprofit through the federal act. A portion of $26.6 million in grants announced earlier this week to help businesses address childcare shortages also came from the American Rescue Plan. "We received overwhelming interest in this unique grant program, which highlights the passion of Iowa's nonprofits and their positive impact on our state," Reynolds said in a news release announcing the funds. "These grants will invest in innovative projects that will put Iowa's nonprofits in a better position to serve those in need." Other funding made available with the money includes $200 million for rural broadband, a $1 million fund to generate tourism and new residents, $30 million for workforce innovations grants, and $100 million to bolster school safety, and $100 million to address water quality. Iowa Senate Majority Leader Zach Walls said in May, when the child care grants were announced, that Reynolds was trying to take credit for the actions taken by Democrats. "The truth is that President Biden and Congresswoman Anks are trying to solve a problem that Kim Reynolds is responsible for, Iowa's worst in the nation child care crisis," he said in a statement. "Iowa Senate Democrats have a plan that would lower costs and make child care more accessible. We're just waiting on Reynolds and Iowa legislative Republicans to work with us." Now let's go on to a new article. The Courier announces this year's 20 under 40 winners. 20 recipients who have been named for the Courier's class of 2022 20 under 40 awards. 20 individuals who are doing good work and serving their communities in the Cedar Valley were selected by a committee whose members sorted through nearly 100 nominations in the 20th annual award. In July, the Courier began seeking nominations for the award, which honors outstanding young leaders in the Cedar Valley who are making a difference in their work and personal lives to make the area a better place. The individuals will be featured in the Cedar Valley Business Monthly magazine in November, and then featured on weekdays in the Courier beginning in December. A special event honoring 20 under 40 winners will take place from 5:30 to 7:30, November 16th at Hilton Garden Inn, 7213 Nordic Drive. Tickets are $10 per person, and children 10 and under are free. Light appetizers and beverages will be served. Tickets must be purchased in advance and will be available beginning Monday at go.wcfcourier.com/20under40. This year's recipients are Quilisha Williams, 34, Manager, Human Resource Consultant, CUNA Mutual Group, Waverly. Tyler Burke, 38, Partner, Business Solutions Advisor, The Excel Group, Waverly. Mikala Montgomery, 32, Assistant Principal, Dr. Walter Cunningham School for Excellence, Waterloo. Matthew Gilbert, 36, Consultant, MRG Law, LLC, Waterloo. Rebecca McCarthy, 38, Director of Mission Engagement, Boys and Girls Club at the Cedar Valley, Waterloo. Nilvia Rodriguez, 29, Migrant and Seasonal Farm Worker Outreach Specialist, Iowa Works, Waterloo. Abby Schrader, 37, Advanced Registered Nurse Practitioner, Cedar Falls Cardiology, Waterloo. Adita Begic, 36, President, Fine Valley Real Estate, Cedar Falls. Kingsley Botchway, 36, Regional Director of Human Resources, Unity Point Health, Waterloo. Ty Smith, 30, Fitness Instructor, Bodied by Ty Fitness, Waterloo. Michelle Sweeney, 37, Professional Engineer and Senior Project Manager, ACOM, Waterloo. Natalie Hunter, 37, Regional Director of Pharmacy Services, Unity Point, Waterloo and Marshalltown. Court Holub, 28, Farmer, Holub Land Farm, Buckingham. Aaron Bishop, 38, Vice President of Strategy, Amperage Marketing and Fundraising, Cedar Falls. Eshan Vapai, 37, Attorney and Partner at Ball, Kirk and Holm, PC, Cedar Falls. Megan Drost, 36, Cedar Falls Schools. Seth Voigt, 37, Project Manager, Turnkey Associates, LC, Waterloo. Jamika Sanders, 36, Residential Supervisor, First Judicial District Department of Correctional Services, Waterloo Women's Center for Change, Waterloo. Josh Wilson, 34, Senior Publicist, Otter PR, Cedar Falls. Jordan Dunn, 35, Clinical Director, Pathways Behavioral Services, in Waterloo. Now let's go on to Monsignor Walter Brunken, former Columbus principal, dies at 92. Whether someone was Catholic or not, Monsignor Walter Brunken accepted everyone. That was evident as the entire town of Green surrounded him in the days before he died, Friday at age 92. Sherilyn Backer, a retired staff member at St. Mary's Church, said this, noting Brunken was a warm, loving person and the best Christian you could ever be. One of the greatest gifts you can give anyone is your time, and he was phenomenal at that, Dan Castle, Brunken's executor, said. Just mentioning his name would turn heads. Brunken was assigned to the church in Green, with sister parishes in Roseville and Rockford in 1991. He was a pastor there until his retirement in 2019. He was famous for his short sermons, both Backer and Castle said, keeping them at a quick 10 minutes. Castle said that Brunken learned this while leading Columbus Catholic High School in Waterloo from 1959 to 1991. If you talked longer than 10 minutes, people would shut you out, especially students, Castle said. People couldn't wait to hear his sermons, rather it be drudgery or use the time to shut your eyes. Brunken was the associate principal from the first day of school from the first day the school opened and began serving as principal in 1968. E.J. Gallagher III, a 1967 Columbus graduate, said, "You'll hear many good things about Brunkin. A lot of people remember all the clocks he made over the years." Brunkin was a woodworker and made at least 250 grandfather clocks, working on them up until 2019. Backer's husband, Rick, helped Brunkin finish his last clock. He was a skilled carpenter as well. For Christmas, we'd always get some kind of a piece of furniture, for at least 30 years, Bracken said, laughing. In a previous Courier article, an auctioneer said that one of the greatest attractions at the annual Cedar Valley Catholic School's ultimate auction was Brunkin's clocks. He said each clock brought in at least $10,000. Apart from the auctions, Brunkin spent a lot of his time volunteering. If there was a committee or board in Green, he would be on it, Backer said. In Waterloo, he was named the Chamber of Commerce Citizen of the Year in 1989. Both Backer and Castle said that they learned kindness from Brunkin. "He was the most kind-hearted person you could ever meet," Backer said. "I just never saw him turn anybody away that needed spiritual, physical, or financial help. He was the best person." And now let's go on to the article. The National Cattle Congress Fair brings cows to the barn. Fair starting Thursday has more dairy cattle. Visitors to this year's 112th National Cattle Congress Fair Thursday through next Sunday will see more dairy cattle in the barns. "Our numbers for dairy are way up, 15% over last year's fair," said General Manager Jim Koch. "We've been really pushing dairy because that's what we're all about. It's our history. We have dairy cattle coming from all over Iowa and surrounding states for a two-day show." Koch expects the grounds at 257 Ansborough Avenue to be filled with fun seekers and families enjoying a variety of attractions, vendors, and exhibits, a carnival fair and fair food. The theme continues to be, "It's everyone's fair." There will be plenty of free entertainment, something different every day. Estes Hall is completely sold out with exhibitors. "We have lots of new food vendors on the grounds, including food trucks." Wednesday's fair previews opens at 4 p.m. with exhibits, carnival, and stage performances, including the Flying Cortez Trapeze Spectacular. Admission is $5. "People can come in and stroll the fair, getting their Tom Thumb mini donuts and getting a taste of the fair. Exhibitors will still be moving, but the carnival will be operating," said Koch. "The fair officially gets underway Thursday. Gates open at 9 a.m. through next Sunday. Admission is $6 for children ages 6 to 12, $10 for 13 and older, and $8 for seniors ages 60 and older, $5 for veterans, and free for all children ages 5 and under. Kids' Day is Friday, and Family Day is Sunday. Carnival hours are 5 to 9 p.m. Wednesday, 5 to 10 p.m. Thursday, noon to 5 p.m. and 6 to 11 p.m. Friday and Saturday, and noon to 5 p.m. Sunday. The Iowa Rodeo Association Cowboy Finals take place 7 p.m. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in the Hippodrome. When the dust settles, top honors will be awarded at the sanctioned event. Tractor pulls are from 1 to 5 p.m. Saturday in the Hippodrome and the National Cattle Congress Motorex Clash at the fair races will start at 5 p.m. Saturday at the NCC Extreme Moto Park. Home arts and horticulture will be on display at the Ag Building, including the King Arthur Baking Contest at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, following from 3 to 5 p.m. by the 2022 Mayor Cookie Jar Contest. The cookie jars will be auctioned at 6 p.m. There will be a Blue Ribbon Row Dairy Exhibit, the Hall of Breeds, and other livestock exhibits and shows. The Fall Harvest Llama Show is from 10 a.m. to noon Saturday and 9 a.m. to Sunday in South Anniversary Hall. The Black Hawk Saddle Club will present a horse show from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in Pullen Simpsons Arena. Dairy shows will include the Youth Dairy Show and the Supreme Champion Heifer Dish Scholarship Show at 9:30 a.m. Saturday in the Hippodrome. At 11 a.m. Saturday, a celebrity milking contest takes place in the historic milking parlor. Livestock shows are what fairs were built for, but we've integrated those with other forms of entertainment, said Koch. At the Cattle Congress, we want to keep the traditions alive and combine that with new and exciting things to see and do. A complete schedule of events is available at https://nationalcattlecongress.com/2022-fair-schedule. Now let's go on to a more international article. Study: Climate Change, One Factor in Pakistan Floods. Climate change likely juiced rainfall by up to 50% late last month in two southern Pakistan provinces, but global warming wasn't the biggest cause of the country's catastrophic flooding that has killed more than 1,500 people, a new scientific analysis found. Pakistan's overall vulnerability, including people living in harm's way, is the chief factor in the disaster that has one point submerged one-third of the country underwater, but human-caused climate change also plays a really important role here, said study senior author Frederike Otto, a climate scientist at Imperial College of London. There are many ingredients to the still ongoing humanitarian crisis, some meteorological, some economic, some societal, some historic, and construction-oriented. Add to that weather records that don't go back far enough in time. With such complications and limitations, the team of international scientists looking at the disaster couldn't quantify how much climate change increased the likelihood and frequency of the flooding, said authors of the study. It was released Thursday, but is it not yet peer-reviewed? What happened would have been a disastrously high rainfall event without climate change, but it's worse because of climate change, Otto said. And especially in this highly vulnerable region, small changes matter a lot. But other human factors that put people in harm's way and weren't adequate to control the water were even bigger influences. This disaster was the result of vulnerability that was constructed over many years, said study team member Aisha Siddiqui of the University of Cambridge. August rainfall in Sindh and Balochistan provinces, together nearly the size of Spain, was 8 and nearly 7 times normal amounts, while the country as a whole had 3.5 times its normal rainfall, according to the report by the World Weather Attribution, a collection of mostly volunteer scientists from around the world who do real-time studies of extreme weather to look at the fingerprints of climate change. The team looked at just two provinces over 5 days and saw an increase of up to 50% in the intensity of rainfall that was likely due to climate change. They also looked at the entire Indus region over 2 months and saw up to 30% increase in rainfall there. The scientists not only examined records of past rains, which only go back to 1961, but they used computer simulations to compare what happened last month to what would have happened in a world without heat-trapping gases from the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas. And that the difference is what they can attribute to climate change. This is a scientifically valid technique, according to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. Study co-author Fahad Saeed, a climate scientist in Islamabad, Pakistan, said numerous factors made this monsoon season much wetter than normal, including La Niña, the natural cooling part of the Pacific that alters weather worldwide. But other factors had the signature of climate change, Saeed said. A nasty heat wave in the region earlier in the summer, which made 30 times more likely because of climate change, increased the differential between the land and water temperatures. That differential determines how much moisture goes from the ocean to a monsoon, and means more of it drops. Climate change seemed to be slightly changed the jet stream, storm tracks, and where low pressure sits, bringing more rainfall for southern provinces than they usually get, Saeed said. Pakistan has not contributed much in terms of causing global climate change, but sure is having to deal with a massive amount of climate change consequences, said University of Michigan Environment Dean Jonathan Overpeck, who wasn't part of the study. Overpeck and three other outside climate scientists said the study makes sense and is nuanced properly to bring in all risk factors. The nuances help avoid overinterpretation, said Stanford University climate scientist Chris Field. But we also want to avoid missing the main message. Human-caused climate change is increasing the risks of extreme events around the world, including the devastating 2022 Pakistan flooding. Now let's go back to another Iowa article. Hinson joins Rubio in proposing a raise in federal child tax credit. 2 days after co-sponsoring a bill that would ban abortions nationwide after 15 weeks, Iowa Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson joined U.S. Senator Marco Rubio from Florida to introduce legislation they say will provide support for expecting moms and families. The legislation combines existing bills with new proposals, including an expansion of the federal child tax credit. I believe being pro-life means supporting women during their pregnancy and beyond, and this package builds on my pro-life efforts in Congress, including stillbirth prevention and working to expand maternal health care services in our rural communities, Hinson told reporters on Friday. Hinson was among more than 80 U.S. House Republicans, including fellow Iowa GOP House member Marionette Miller Meeks and Randy Feenstra, who this week co-sponsored the House version of a bill introduced Tuesday by South Carolina Republican U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham that would create a nationwide ban on abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The bill would allow for exceptions in cases of incest, rape, or if the mother's life is in danger. Asked about the timing and whether the new legislation was meant to work in concert with Graham's proposed abortion ban, Hinson said that she had been working with Rubio on the proposal for months. I think it's an important time to lay our claim for why this is our value statement and why we believe this is the answer to help working families keep more of their hard-earned money, Hinson told reporters on Friday. Hinson is proposing an increase in the federal child tax credit, raising it above the level established last year in the 2021 American Rescue Plan Act, which she opposed. Hinson also voted against the Build Back Better Act, which passed the House but died in the Senate, which would have extended the child tax credit through 2022. Hinson has rallied against the social spending package and the deficit reduction package, which is paid for with new taxes on large companies and stepped up IRS enforcement on wealthy individuals and entities. She has argued the legislation represents more federal government taxing, spending, and overreach that will not constrain inflation. She told reporters Friday, "I've expressed my past support for the child tax credit, so nothing is new in terms of my philosophical belief behind it." Under the Hinson-Rubio bill, parents would receive a monthly child allowance of up to $4,500 for children ages 5 and below, and up to $3,500 for children ages 6 to 17. The new child care tax credit would maintain the current phase-out thresholds of $200,000 for single fillers and $400,000 for married joint fillers. Expecting parents would also be able to claim the credit, according to Hinson's office, helping families offset costs for the child during a woman's pregnancy. Hinson's bill will also make the federal adoption tax credit refundable. She said the package of bills expands access to important federal resources and grant programs and recognizes the importance of community and faith-based services. And it empowers parents to raise happy, healthy babies regardless of socioeconomic status. Other provisions of the bill would allow parents to pull forward up to 3 months of Social Security benefits to finance parental leave, establish a federal clearinghouse of resources available to pregnant mothers, expand WIC, which is Women, Infants, and Children eligibility for postpartum and breastfeeding mothers up to 2 years after birth. WIC is a supplemental nutrition program for babies and children under the age of 5, and pregnant women, breastfeeding women, and women who have had a baby in the last 6 months. encouraged states to establish rules requiring the father to cover half a woman's pregnancy costs and strengthen child support enforcement, and make it easier for faith-based organizations to secure federal grants for social service programs, including those that provide pregnancy and adoption counseling for expecting and new parents. Democratic state lawmaker Liz Mathis, who is running to challenge Hinson for Iowa's 2nd congressional district seat in the November 8th election, said that Hinson's claims of seeking to uplift and strengthen Iowa's families with her self-described pro-family proposals ring hollow given Hinson's support and extreme nationwide ban on abortion, and opposition to bills by House Democrats that sought to make childcare more affordable. Mathis, too, argued that Hinson's proposals allowing workers to trade part of their future Social Security retirement benefits for parental leave after the birth or adoption of a child would undercut Social Security benefits and structure, weakening the retirement security it offers workers and making parents choose between staying home to care for their baby or retirement security. Instead, Mathis advocated for a national comprehensive paid family leave policy. Once again, Representative Ashley Hinson is trying to hide her record of working in Washington to hurt Iowa families, Mathis said. Now let's go on to Campaign Almanac. Iowa Corn Growers Association endorses candidates for state and federal offices. The Iowa Corn Growers Association made endorsements in several elections this week, endorsing mostly Republicans running for statewide and federal office. Governor Kim Reynolds, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, and incumbent U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra, Ashley Hinson, Marionette Miller Meeks, all Republicans, announced endorsements from the organization that represents Iowa's corn farmers. Iowa's Republican Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig also announced the group's endorsement. "Corn grows Iowa," Reynolds said in a tweet announcing the endorsement. "Working alongside the Iowa corn to support our producers who feed and fuel the world." In a statement, Grassley said that his experience as a farmer helps him understand the problems facing Iowans in the agricultural industry. "It's an honor to have the support of the Iowa corn growers and to have their endorsement of my work for them in Congress," he said. Iowa Senator Kevin Kinney, a Democrat from Oxford, also announced that he had received the group's endorsement. There's a subheader that says, "Grassley's long tenure." A new ad from U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley's campaign highlights Grassley's 99-county tour and long history in the Senate. The ad calls Grassley a farmer, push-up, pro, runner, husband, father, and champion for Iowa. "He visits all 99 counties every year, has the best attendance record in the Senate ever, and if re-elected, Chuck Grassley will have the most seniority in the entire Senate," the narrator says in the ad. "It's easier to fight the rising cost of living when you have the clout," the ad continues. Grassley is seeking his 8th term in the Senate and faces Democratic challenger, retired Navy Admiral Mike Franken. Grassley is the second longest-serving U.S. senator after 8-term Democrat from Vermont, Patrick Leahy, who is retiring at the end of 2022. Re-electing Chuck Grassley this fall ensures that Iowa will be well represented for the next 6 years. "Our newest ad reminds Iowans why the senator we need is the senator we've got." Grassley's campaign spokesperson, Michelle Sunderman, said in a press release. Franken's spokesperson, C.J. Peterson, said on Twitter that the ad highlights Grassley as a lifelong career politician. Senator Grassley admits that he's a lifelong career politician in his new ad, which somehow means that we should give him an 8th 6-year term to fix the things he broke 4 terms ago. "Wild stuff," Peterson tweeted. Another subheader, law enforcement lauded. Democratic state lawmaker Liz Mathis, who is running to challenge Republican incumbent U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson for Iowa's 2nd congressional district seat in the November 8th election, is up with a new ad emphasizing her record of supporting and funding law enforcement. "With violent crime increasing in many parts of the country, Republicans see a winning strategy in portraying Democrats as soft on crime ahead of this year's election, using calls from some progressive activists to defund the police as a political attack line. In campaign appearances and interviews, Hinson has criticized liberal policies and blamed Democratic lawmakers and the White House for rising crime. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 18th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Let's finish up the article we're reading right now, and then we'll turn to today's obituaries. Continuing the article about Iowa Corn Growers Association endorsing candidates for state and federal offices, Democrats, though, have been quick to note a handful of Republican lawmakers have called for the FBI to be defunded or abolished in the wake of a criminal investigation into classified documents seized at former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate last month. Lynn County Sheriff Breyer Gardner, a Democrat in the 32nd ad, says that he doesn't care for politicians who want to defund the police or lie and say their opponents do. Black Hawk County Sheriff Tony Thompson, a fellow Democrat, called Mathis a longtime friend of local law enforcement who worked in the Iowa Senate to fully fund training and protective equipment for Iowa law enforcement. In Congress, I will continue to have the backs of all federal and state local enforcement officers, Mathis said in a statement. The TV ads will air on broadcast cable and streaming services in the Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, Dubuque, Rochester, Mason City media markets. To date, the Mathis campaign said that it has placed $435,000 for TV media to buy, with another long-term media placement being reserved. Liz Mathis isn't pro-law enforcement, Hinson's campaign manager Sophie Crowell said. She voted against imposing tougher penalties against those who attack law enforcement and is surrounding herself with defund the police activists. Meanwhile, attacks against law enforcement, fueled by Washington's Democrats' soft-on-crime rhetoric, are at an all-time high. Ashley will always back the blue and stand strong against the radical defund the police movement that hurts Iowa's law enforcement and makes our communities less safe. Hinson released her first TV ad last week, emphasizing her support of veterans as part of what her campaign said would be a more than $2 million ad campaign through Election Day. Now let's move over to today's obituaries, starting with Dolores Irene Nedrow. Dolores Irene Nedrow, 81, of Independence, Iowa, died Thursday, September 15th, 2022, at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Dolores was born on February 7th, 1941, in Vinton, Iowa, the daughter of Lauren and Mary Rommelsberg. She graduated with the class of 1959, from the Brandon High School, Brandon, Iowa. On April 2nd, 1960, she was united into marriage to Rolf Nedrow in Vinton, Iowa. She became employed with Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids, retiring in 1999 after 40 years of service. She enjoyed hootenannies and watching TV, especially game shows. She is survived by a son, Logan Nedrow, and a stepdaughter, Charmaine, two grandchildren, Cameron and Haley Nedrow, two sisters, Joyce Betts and of Johnston, Iowa, and Sharon Mills of Independence, Iowa, Karen King, Brandon, Iowa, and a brother, Donald Rammelsberg of Waterloo, Iowa. Dolores was preceded in death by her husband, Ralph Nedrow, in 2005, two brothers, Harold and Dallas Rammelsberg. Memorial services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, September 19th, 2022, at the Independence Community Bible Church, with Pastor Mike Nemers officiating. Burial will be held at a later date in the Lynn Wood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Friends may call from 9 a.m. to services Monday at the church. The Reef Family Center in Independence is assisting the family with arrangements. To leave online condolences, please go to www.reeffamilycenter.com under obituaries. Francis Xavier Walter. Francis Xavier Walter, 92, of Cedar Falls, died Tuesday, September 13th, at his home. He was born September 8th, 1930, in Waterloo, the son of Oscar and Leon Mergen Walter. He married Patricia Holbrook on June 11th, 1951, in Waterloo. Francis served in the United States Navy during the Korean War. He was employed as a salesman for Key Electric Supply and retired as president of Electrical Control Systems. Survivors include his wife, Patricia of Cedar Falls, his children, Rebecca Morris of Menomonee Falls, Wisconsin, Stephen Walter of Clive, Karen Waddell of Johnston, Dave Walter of Pewaukee, Wisconsin, and Julie Bugart of Cedar Falls. 9 grandchildren, 7 great-grandchildren, and 1 great-great-grandchild, his brother Paul Walter of Waterloo. Preceded in death by his daughter, Barbara Walter, in infancy, his siblings, Dorothy Macrice, Margaret Kunstling, and Mary Lou Sadler. Memorial Mass by Christian Burial at 10:30 a.m. Friday, September 23rd at the Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church with interment at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Full military rites will be conducted by the Evansdale Amvets, Post 31, assisted by the Navy Honor Guard. Public visitation 1 hour prior to the Mass at the church. Haggerty Wachoff Group Funeral Services on West Ridgeway is assisting the family. Memorials may be directed to the Cedar Valley Hospice or the Blessed Sacrament Church. Condolences may be left at www.haggertywachoffgroup.com. Benny Stickley. Benny Stickley, age 82, of Gilberville, passed away Tuesday, August 30th, 2022. Benny was born on August 29th, 1940, son of Robert and Lucille Stickley. Benny worked for John Deere many years, then retired. Benny loved fishing, camping, hunting, and traveling. He married Marty Spuden in Waterloo, February 23, 1999. He is survived by his wife, Marty, 2 sons, Ricky Stickley, St. Olaf, and Dale Stickley, Cedar Falls, 4 stepsons, John Jacoby, Tama, Joe Jacoby, Waterloo, Jerome Jacoby, Waterloo, Gary Bartlett of Hudson, 2 daughters, Teresa Meester of Parkersburg, 1 stepdaughter of Marshall, 2 New York, 2 brothers, Oscar Stickley of New York, Craig Stickley of Parkersburg, 6 grandchildren, Travis Meester of Minnesota, Kim Meester of New York, Taylor Meester of Waterloo, Brandon Meester of Parkersburg, and Brent A. Bartlett of Hudson. Granddaughter Kaya Meester of Parkersburg, 1 sister Bonnie Horn of Waterloo, and many nieces and nephews. Per his wish, there will be no funeral services. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, September 24th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. at Majestic Moon, 1955 Locke Avenue, Waterloo. Now let's move over to the sports section, starting with some college football. Mistakes, inconsistencies cost you and I an upset bid of number 8 Hornets. Costly mistakes and inconsistency plagued the Northern Iowa football team as the Panthers lost their 3rd straight game, 37-21, to number 8 Sacramento State Saturday. With the loss, you and I falls to 0-3 to start their season for their first time since 1969. According to UNI head coach Mark Farley, the onus is on the Panthers as a whole to climb out of their early season deficit. Getting all upset and hollering at people will not make it better, Farley said. They are going to need to find a way to get this done. We have played some good football teams, this team and Air Force, but as you can see, this game, we could have won this game. The Panthers stumbled out of the gate on offense and opened the door for the high-powered Hornets offense, led by quarterback Jake Dunaway and Asher O'Hara, to build an insurmountable first-half lead. After forcing 3 and outs on UNI's first 2 drives, the Hornets took over their own 32-yard line. The Hornets drove down to the UNI 18 over the next 8 plays, but a sack by Spencer Colavier sent up a critical 3rd and 12 from the UNI 20. Dunaway found Pierre Williams over the middle for a gain of 14 and the first down. 2 plays later, O'Hara punched it in from 3 yards out to take a 7-0 lead. UNI responded right back with a 10-play, 75-yard to even the score at 7-7. After Vance McShane's 2-yard run gave the Panthers a new set of downs at the Sac State 38, Day connected with tight end Alex Allen on a 24-yard pass. Two plays later, after avoiding disaster on a fumble recovered by UNI, Day found Allen in the end zone for a 17-yard touchdown pass, with the remaining 1 minute and 8 seconds remaining in the first quarter. Sac State did not miss a beat as the Hornets drove the ball 75 yards in 7 plays to regain the advantage. With the ball on the UNI 21, Dunaway found tight end Marshall Martin over the middle. Martin made the grab around the UNI 5 and waltzed into the end zone to put Sac State on top 14-7. Following the third UNI 3 and out of the game, the Hornets took over on their own 48-yard line. The Hornets mixed it up as O'Hara, normally a running quarterback, threw the ball 4 times for 26 yards. O'Hara finished off the drive with his second touchdown on the ground to put Sacramento State up to 21-7. In dire need of an answer, UNI took over on its own 25-yard line. However, after picking up a first down on a 15-yard run by running back Dom Williams, UNI wide receiver Quan Hampton fumbled the ball near midfield. The Panthers managed to stop the Hornets' drive at the UNI 12 as junior DB Wu Governor broke up a pass in the corner of the end zone on a 3rd and 6. Sac State kicker Kyle Sentkowski converted on a 29-yard field goal attempt to take a 17-24-7 lead. For the first time since their touchdown drive, UNI managed to put together a sustained drive as Vance McShane rattled off runs of 17 and 20 yards, and Day connected on a 16-yard pass to play Sam Schnee. However, the Panthers came up empty as the drive stalled at the Sac State 13, and Matthew Cook's 30-yard field goal attempt missed left. At the half, UNI went to the locker trailing 24-7 after putting up 210 yards of total offense. Untimely mistakes caused UNI as a pair of first-half fumbles halted promising drives. "There was way too much error," Farley said. "There were too many missed tackles, too many dropped balls. We've got to tackle. We've had our opportunities." UNI answered the challenge from its head coach by forcing a 3-and-out and a punt on the Hornets' opening drive of the second half. Facing a 3rd-and-4, UNI defensive lineman Jack Krebs chased down Dunaway in the back for a sack, taking over on its own 44. The UNI offense rode the momentum created by the defensive stand and drove 56 yards for its second touchdown of the contest. Trailing 24-14, UNI appeared to be primed to steal back momentum and claw back into the game, but after the defense forced a second Sac State punt of the half, UNI's defense went 3-and-out for the fourth time. The Hornets capitalized on a short field and drove 30 yards to the UNI 12. The Hornets extended their advantage 27-14 on the 29-yard field goal from Sentkowski. UNI bounced back on its next drive as Theo Day led another 10-play, 75-yard touchdown drive. Vance McShane capped off the drive with a 4-yard run to cut the Hornets' lead to 27-21. The UNI defense managed to force the punt it needed to the ensuing Hornet drive to give the Panthers' offense the ball on its own 30. However, the UNI's drive stalled near midfield, and the Panthers were forced to punt it away with 10 minutes and 4 seconds remaining in the game. Over the next 6 minutes and 24 seconds of the game, Sac State drove 66 yards on an 11-play drive, consisting of 9 running plays to kill the clock. Sentkowski capped the drive with a 37-yard field goal to put Sac State up by 2 scores, 30-21. The drive mirrored a similar drive a week ago when North Dakota iced a win with a 7-minute and 8-second drive in the fourth quarter of the Panthers' 29-27 loss. Farley said his team needed to clean up its missed tackles to get off the field in those types of situations. "You have to tackle," Farley said. "There are a lot of things that go into tackling, and half of it is heart. You get off the field by tackling. If you tackle them and give them 3, 4, 5 yards after the initial hit, that is not tackling, that is is holding on. A Theoday interception with 2 minutes and 40 seconds remaining in the game allowed the Hornets to score an effectively meaningless touchdown with 41 seconds remaining to put their 37-21 win on ice. Redshirt junior tight end Alex Allen echoed Farley's comments on it needing to be a team effort to turn around the Panthers' season. A lot of the guys are going to go home tonight, look at themselves in the mirror, and figure out what they can do to help this team, Allen said. We do not want to play the pointing game. Each room needs to look at themselves and see what they need to do better. Then we'll come back on Monday and grow as a team. Now on to more college football. Cyclones improved to 3-0 for the first time in Campbell era. Iowa State first-year starting quarterback Hunter Dickers shined as usual in the passing game. His top target, Xavier Hutchinson, posted big numbers yet again. And the Cyclones cruised to a 43-10 win Saturday over outmanned Ohio at Jack Trice Stadium, while simultaneously proving why their head coach, Matt Campbell, often refers to football as a game of imperfection. Boy, was it ever. ISU coughed up a red zone fumble and saw an extra point blocked, and that was just before trotting into halftime with a 30-3 lead. But the Cyclones also forced four turnovers. Deckers completed 28 of 36 passes for 268 yards and three touchdowns, and Hutchinson caught one of them while amassing at least 93 receiving yards for the sixth time in the past seven regular season games. I was probably irate at halftime just because you're up 30-3 and your eyes see all the things that are going to cost us when we need it the most, Campbell said. And if we don't clean those things up, then we could be happy being 3-0. I'm not. I still feel like there's so much proof of what we can be and what we need to become if we're willing to get there. Deckers was sacked twice in a row on one second half drive, but otherwise was well protected while boosting his career touchdown to interception ratio to 11-4. His three touchdown passes went to Hutchinson, Sean Shaw Jr., and Deshaun Hanika. So he continued to connect these with a diverse range of targets. There are some highs, but there are some lows that we've got to figure out, Campbell said. The ball security piece is something that we've got to continue to strain to work on, and yet there's some critical plays that he makes in a football game that we are not the team we've got the ability to be if he doesn't make those plays. Senior linebacker Orion Vance's strip sack in the second quarter produced a fumble that defensive end MJ Anderson recovered. Senior safety Anthony Johnson rose up for a career-sprawling first-half interception, the first half of his career, and graduate the transfer linebacker Colby Reeder picked off his second pass in as many weeks, returning it to the Bobcats' 9-yard line. Defensive lineman Joey Peterson forced a fourth-quarter fumble that Hunter Zenzen recovered at the Ohio 12-yard line. Jace Gilbert subsequently capped ISU's scoring with a 21-yard field goal with 8 minutes and 14 seconds left, sending swaths of what remained to the announced crowd, 58,138 shuffling towards the exit. Add Will McDonald's program record extending 30th stack, and a recipe for ongoing success emerges, even if some of the ingredients somewhat soured the mix. I'm just blessed to have the ability to do all of that, said McDonald, who notched his first sack of the season. So a lot of good coexisted with a sprinkling of bad for ISU, which is 3-0 to start the season for the first time since 2012, and begins Big 12 play next Saturday against defending conference champion Baylor, 2-1, who is 2-1 at home. It's every week like this, Shaw said. Just because it's Big 12 play, we're not looking at it any different. We're treating every week the same, and it's going to stay that way. Continuing on with college football, but this time small college football, Wartburg pummels Luther 62-0 after explosive first half. Wartburg College rumbled past Luther College 62-0, scoring 55 first-half points in an American Rivers Conference football rout over the Norse at Walston Hoover Stadium. The knights didn't get off to a fantastic start, but once they got charging, there was no stopping them. Wartburg, who's 3-0, drove all the way to the Norse goal line on their opening possession, but missed a field goal. But the knights struck back on the next drive with a 47-yard touchdown run by Bryson White. It was the first time of 9 touchdowns for the Orange and Black. "I would like to have gotten off to a better start, certainly," head coach Chris Winter said. "There's still plenty of things that we're going to have to clean up from today, but yeah, to come out here and come into a rivalry game and have the score be the way it is today, you're excited about that any time you can get the shutout and put one on Luther. We'll take it." The floodgates opened immediately after the first touchdown. There was little Luther could do to slow down the Knights. Tom Butters caught a 5-yard pass from Niall McLaughlin to make it 14-0. Then Carter Henry had a 6-yard scoring run, and before the first quarter was over, Hunter Klassen scampered for a 64-yard scoring run. Then, 12 seconds into the second quarter, Antonio Stantillion returned and intercepted an interception 34 yards for a touchdown. Henry added a 2-yard scoring run. White caught a 9-yard pass from McLaughlin, and Ben Bryant scored a 27-yard run that made it 55-0. Before the season, Winter teased an explosive backfield for Wartburg, which manifested in 345 rushing yards for 6 touchdowns. Clayson led the way with 4 carries for 116 yards, and Bryant carried the ball 14 times for 99 yards. McLaughlin threw for 166 yards. Coupled with their offensive game, the Knights' defense kept Luther inert through all 4 quarters. In addition to a shutout, they held the Norse to only 4 first downs while making 2 interceptions. "It just comes down to the guys up front. We don't have to do a lot of fancy things," Winter said. "I mean, I pretty much call the same things most all day long. Maybe change coverage here and there, but with the front, we're just lining up our base front and letting those guys go to work." Wartburg will play next week at the University of Dubuque. Let's finish off today with some high school football. Grundy Center stays perfect against Pirates. The Grundy Center Spartans rolled to a 47-0 victory over the Hudson Pirates to improve to 4-0 on the season Friday. Grundy Center head coach Travis Zajac said the Spartans knew they needed to get out to a fast start facing a Pirates squad which had allowed only 14 points in its 3 games this season. "Take care of business," Zajac said. "We have played 3 really tough games out of the gate. Hudson was 2-1, and they had a lot of energy and enthusiasm. Their 2 wins were shutouts. Our job was to go over there and squelch their momentum early." Zajac's message showed in the Spartans' play as Grundy Center wide receiver Austin Betts returned the opening kickoff to Pirates territory to the 40-yard line. On their second play from scrimmage, the Spartans scored the first touchdown of the game as junior quarterback Colin Gordon hit sophomore tight end Tyrion Volks on a 38-yard touchdown pass. 4 minutes later, the Spartans scored again as junior defensive lineman Trent Cakerice picked off Hudson quarterback Camden Davis, who was looking for his running back on a screen pass. Cakerice returned the interception 14 yards for a touchdown. Later in the first quarter, Cakerice forced a fumble, which Grundy Center recovered at the Hudson 29 while sacking Davis. Spartans junior running back Clay Sack scored 4 plays later on a 7-yard run to put Grundy Center on the top 20-0 with only 10 minutes and 59 seconds elapsed off the board. In the second quarter, Gordon showed out with a 2-yard rushing touchdown and threw for a pair of touchdowns, including a 42-yard bomb to the junior wide receiver Tate Jervoski. By halftime, Gordon had received 153 passing yards and 3 passing touchdowns to go along with 73 rushing yards and 1 rushing touchdown to put Grundy Center in front 40-0. The junior quarterback credited a combination of weekly preparation, execution, and hard work in the offseason as the recipe which allowed the Spartans to put together its dominating performance Friday. "We prepare the same way every week. Scout them out, coaches come up with a plan," Gordon said. then we execute the plan. Our coaches are big at getting work and the off-season in the weight room. That's a big part of it. We have a really great scheme. The coaches put in a lot of work. Leading 40-0 in the second half, the Spartans flexed the depth of their running back room. Sophomore running back Brody Zincula took his third of 9 carries, all of which came in the second half, 43 yards for a touchdown. We feel like we have three backs that can play, Zajac said. Brody just has had the time in the last 2 weeks. Justin and Clay have gotten the lion's share of the carries. For Brody, it is just a confidence thing, and that is why we wanted to get him out there with the first team O-line. He did a fantastic job out of the gate. By the end of the game, the Spartans had amassed 369 yards of total offense, 216 rushing, 153 passing. Defensively, Grundy Center forced 8 punts and held the Pirates to less than 100 yards. It was a really good night for our kids, as Zajac said. We are excited to continue moving through our schedule. We are a 4-0 football team right now, and they should be proud of that. But we take a lot of pride in day-to-day, week-by-week progression. Next week, the Spartans put their undefeated record on the line against the 3-1 AGWSR Cougars. According to Zajac, the Spartans will not look past any one opponent on their schedule. We know that everybody that plays us wants a piece, Zajac said. They want to get a shot at the team that has been pretty good the last couple of years and wholeheartedly accepted that challenge. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 18th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.